Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to this episode. Really excited about it. We just did, like, in my pre-call or like pre-interview here, we've made a shift in the direction of what we want to talk about. And I think it's going to be a good place that we're going to go with this, because I know that for any of you that actually follow me on social media, you've seen that occasionally I brought up some comments and posts and raising awareness about, you know, gender and, you know, how many of us see the world differently and show up in the world differently and, you know, experience the world differently. And some of it has to do with gender. And in my book, I actually do talk about, you know, not just the psychology and the neuroscience from the perspective of, you know, that I have as a white woman, but I, you know, I also brought in the fact that there are gender roles, biases, and stereotypes that influenced my family, and they influenced the way I was parented. They influenced the messages I received directly and indirectly. And all that also became entangled in my personal belief systems, either through I rejected them outright, or I ended up adopting them without being aware I was actually, you know, playing them through, and that they were also contributions to my self-sabotage in my personal life, my parenting life, as well as my professional life. And so, yes, this is a program that talks about the role of trauma and dysfunction from our past and sometimes in our present lives, and how we need to recognize it, how it's happening, and how what we can do to change it. And I do believe that to do that well, that it is my responsibility to make sure that we peel back all the layers around trauma and where it comes from and why it's there. And so, like I did in my book, I want to do it here today as well with my guest. I believe we have to be aware that there are systems that signaled to our parents and our grandparents what's right and wrong. What rules do we need to be taught in order to perform and behave the right way in the system? And that these binary rules, things like boys have to be tough and girls can't be angry, can themselves be the wellspring for some of the traumas that we've experienced that have ended up shaping us. And so Michelle is an expertise in gender. She's a professor, a gender scholar, and a professional coach. And she puts gender under the microscope and these rules and that they bring into our culture, and works with women to deprogram the rules in ourselves and to how to navigate around them. Because one of the biggest things that we hear about people talking about, men and women both, is this concept of imposter syndrome. You know, where does that actually come from? In fact, I just had a call with a woman a couple of days ago who was describing to me what she'd really like to do with her business. But because she constantly has this voice in her head asking her, what makes you think you're good enough to do that? She came to me because she wanted to explore a different idea instead. And my response to her was, don't you think it'd be worth doing what you really want to do with your life? And if you're having trouble getting there, how about we stop ignoring what's stopping you and actually work on that so that you can then build a business and a life that'll allow you to thrive? And her response was just tepid enthusiasm. In fact, it wasn't even an idea she wanted to consider. It was really uncomfortable for her to consider that concept. And so Michelle's here with us today. She's going to help us understand, you know, not only how to break up with this imposter syndrome, but what we're going to talk about is how do we talk about the gender roles, the gender biases that exist in this patriarchal system without it becoming a polarizing, galvanizing, triggering conversation for everybody that's involved. And so I'm really excited to have you here with me today, Michelle.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. And I love our little twist, our little plot twist, what we're going to do today.
Yeah. And, you know, plot twist, like I said, it came up because I have, you know, made some posts. You know, one time this past summer, I was talking about the differences in the, you know, the Seattle Reign won the WNBA championships. Yay, hurrah. And so I put a big post out there about the differences in pay that exist in the WNBA versus the NBA. And the classic responses back were, well, the NBA makes more money, and so that's why they can pay more. And I kept trying to drill this down to, but why do they make more money? Well, people like watching the NBA more than the WNBA more. Okay, but why is that the case? Like, you know, basketball is basketball. It's great to watch it. And out of the conversation, you could see the things like, well, you know, there's just more market share for them. And there's just all of this and all of these things. And I was trying to get to a place of, yeah, but I also remember being told that women aren't good at basketball and that women's basketball games are boring and that, you know, and all that stuff. And all those things got planted into why we believe that we should pay more to watch men play ball versus women play ball. Some people got it. And then some, like I said, men got triggered. And because I know my listeners are actually more men, believe it or not, out there are listeners of One Broken Mom than women. This conversation is an attack on men, as you and I had made our plot twist determination, but it is to talk about it in a way that we can say, listen, it hurts us all, right? Like, that's your thing, is the patriarchy and these gender roles don't just hurt women. They hurt everybody. So I want you to start off from there. How is that possible that we all are injured by a gender bias or gender stereotypes?
Right, right. So that's a great question. And I also want to say, and it's okay if you feel uncomfortable. Like, that's perfect. That's great. That means we're getting through something, right? That maybe is a limiting belief, or it's just something that's been there and been unquestioned for a really long time. And so those are the conversations that we need to have. But patriarchy is a system. You know, people think of it as like male bashing, or we're talking about individuals. We're talking about all of us who are living within a system. A system of power. And yes, the system of power is about male leadership, preserving male power and putting, you know, men, and then not all men, right? Certain men, because there's also other layers of privilege that we have to talk about, including race and ability and age and, you know, all of it. But maintaining that male power and making sure that those men stay in power. And certainly we can sprinkle other folks around, you know, and help them to see that maybe there's a benefit for them to continue to uphold the system. So they get a little power, but, you know, it's not true like liberatory power, right? It's not true freedom. And so it creates this idea that there's a pie and, you know, there's only so much power to go around and you're going to take it from me and I have to fight for what I have and to keep what I have. And so it's really just set up to be adversarial for everybody. And so when I talk about patriarchy, one of the reasons I talk about it is to acknowledge the system, because it's often erased. It's like when we talk about gender, people think we're talking about women as if gender isn't about men too, right? Or that we talked about in this binary, and I was so glad to hear you say that, like male and female, as if there's nothing in between. And I think we're seeing more than ever, especially when we talk about pronouns, you know, that there's a lot of different ways that people identify, and it's a lot more nuanced and complicated than what we thought. But yeah, patriarchy is a system of power. And then there are like these expectations of men and women. So it creates a binary, and then it creates a set of expectations that you have to meet. And a lot of times those expectations are contradictory. You can't speak up, but not speak up too much. What does that even mean? You know, so it's really complicated for everybody, for all of us who are, like I said, kind of swimming in the pool of the patriarchy, and it's around us and we don't even really realize it. And so what I do, well, I've been a professor, you know, for about 16 years now already, and I'm a feminist coach. And what I do in both of those, you know, parts of my life is we look at the gender norms, those lessons that we were taught, because they're so foundational. And a lot of my clients who are feminists, probably in a lot of ways identify differently, they get confused about like how they're so progressive and liberatory and such strong women. And then why does this creep up? Why do they have this question about, you know, should I say something? And they have a PhD, but am I qualified to say this in this meeting? You know, they get really worried. Or, you know, like those of us who write, when you put it out there, there's this worry that we think of as imposter syndrome. That's a familiar concept, that someone's going to find out that we really don't know what we're talking about.
My heart's just like, my chest is tightening, because that's a, like, that's a feel. Like, I get that. Like, it's a terrifying feel for sure. Keep going.
Yes, my chest tightens up too when I think about it. And that's my own, you know, stress response from that training that I had. So what we do is we take a look at the fact that these beliefs are still under there, and we've got to kind of mine through them and see how they're showing up today, and then developing skills to just notice them gently, you know, and lovingly, and know that they were there at a time to kind of keep us safe. And, you know, there were some good reasons that they were there, but they don't fit us, right? And that's what patriarchy does, is it tries to put us all into a specific category. And obviously that doesn't work, because we're all individuals with our own strengths and skills and passions. But within a patriarchal system, we're not always asked what we want. You know, when I ask my clients, what do you want? And they don't know, because no one ever asks them. They know what they're supposed to do, or yeah, they think they know what they're supposed to do, right? And then they're confused about why they're unhappy doing the thing they're supposed to do. And then it creates shame, which means then they don't want to even talk about it at all, because they just feel bad, because they should have it all, and yet they're unhappy. So I talk about the patriarchy because I want to put that out there and get us more comfortable using that language, and to show that it's not, you know, a competition between people. It's not about finger pointing to individuals. It's about looking at maybe individual actions within a systemic view, looking at the system itself and how it creates limitations for certain people and opportunities possibly for others.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things when you were beginning in the word power, that's why I want to zero in here for a moment on that, because, you know, I am a mother of a daughter and a son. And so I want, you know, equal chances and equal opportunities for both of them, you know, to succeed. And so I don't want a world in which the tables turn and my son now is becoming disadvantaged because he happens to be a white male, you know, growing up in this world. And I think when I go back and I think about some of my listeners who identify as white males, that's the fear that they have, that when we talk about dismantling a patriarchal system or recreating systems that are fair and equal, that that sometimes that means taking power away, taking privileges away from somebody. And of course, that sounds scary and terrifying. Like, you're talking to me about, you know, is there a chance that I did get ahead, or I got better, or is my current state in life going to be reduced because we're coming in and we're making these changes? And I think that's then where you see, in my opinion, that's where you see this resistance to having that conversation, because, okay, you're saying that there's power out there and I have power and you want that to change. That means you're going to take my power away. But when we talk about disrupting the system, are we really talking about taking a whole bunch of white men and taking away all their toys? Right. And then they can't move forward anymore? Or is there something else that's going on in this whole restructuring?
Right. Right. We're not talking about creating a radical matriarchy. one time somebody said that to me, that I was creating some ungodly matriarchy, or that was my plan. I think that was the language on social media. And that's not the plan, right? Because it's still an unfair system. It's still this hierarchy, and it's still based on gender taking something away, right, from certain people, or putting only certain people in power. And I have to say, you know, I'm a parent of three, and two identify as female and one male, and they're white folks. And, you know, I don't want that for my kids either, you know, and I think being a parent sometimes gives us an opportunity to really see what patriarchy and those gender roles look like. I mean, it's really surprising when you see all of a sudden the expectations on parents and on kids, and you're like, oh no, I'm raising my kid to be different. What's that like? And it's not an easy road, right? From a very early age. But getting back to your original question about power, no, it's not about recreating any sort of new hierarchy. It's about looking at it in terms of justice and equity. And I know we're not going to get to anything that's like a level playing field. But when we think of it in terms of this, there's kind of like this visual out there, right? There's people trying to look over a fence and the ground is kind of hilly, you know, and some are taller and some are shorter and some have glasses and some don't, you know, and they need the different levels of boxes, right? That's more about the kind of, I think, way and approach that we're looking at it, that people have goals and people have dreams and how can we help them achieve all of that? And how can we each, you know, kind of work together in that system to make it more just for everybody? And that means it's sometimes uncomfortable because I've benefited unfairly because of my race. That's an unearned privilege. And if I ignore it and I'm too stressed out and too guilt-ridden to deal with it, I'm never going to feel okay. And I'm never going to help the system heal either. Right. And so it's all about having these conversations and it's okay to feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And of course we say that, but some people really have discomfort feeling uncomfortable. Like that's the first barrier in the block to it. I mean, you know, we talk about this, I mean, in all kinds of things, like our fear is our strongest motivator to do or not to do things. And when instantly your fear, it joins the conversation, your rational, you know, abilities are not there. Like fear is driving all of that. And that's why I, like I said, this kind of, we weaved here into this conversation, because what I'd like to see as an outcome is, you know, how do we feel the fear and then be able to get ourselves back to a place where we can talk about this again in our lives and, you know, through our parenting and also through our businesses and leadership and, you know, all the areas and where this is a really important conversation. The conflicting messages, you know, you brought that up and I actually had that as a note that I wanted to talk about because I've been in the situation, which is why I knew I needed to bring in gender role biases and stereotypes into my book about what it takes to be, you know, to start a business and be an entrepreneur. You know, the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business means you also have to notice that, you know, those things happen and that we have those conflicts inside of ourselves of, yeah, I mean, I, of course, you know, had no question I was going to go into, you know, take on a job and a role in a male dominated field. And I was going to play sports and I was going to reject wearing pink and I was going to get tattoos and I was going to do all my things, you know, but yet at the same time, why do I feel really scared in my gut to talk about money? And why can I not ask for a raise? And why am I backpedaling right now? And why am I taking on all the household responsibilities when I feel trapped and I hate this, but yet I don't know how to stop this? And I mean, so that dichotomy does happen in, you know, in a lot of people. And it, and I, you know, we know, I, you know, because we hear men talk about it, it happens in them as well, but they also have the conflicting messages that play out inside of their own heads. From that perspective, you know, is that all related to the gender role, you think, or is a lot of that related to the subconscious gender roles that our parents played for us or told us that we needed to fall in line with?
I think a lot of them are. And, you know, keep in mind, these weren't our ideas. These weren't even our parents' ideas or our grandparents' ideas, yet we do carry the burden of them, right? And they are very real. And I think that they intersect with some other systems too. Patriarchy is not the only system. There's systems based on race, systems based on, you know, economics, right, that we're dealing with in this country. And then just look around the world and you see some other systems at play. But what you always see is a gender system. Always. There's always that element there. So, you know, I think that we have to acknowledge at least that gender has played a part in our development of all these different beliefs. I think about it as someone who was raised in a rural kind of small town Midwest community that was very religiously conservative. And, you know, I had an experience of family trauma at a very young age with gun violence in my life. And so that sort of, you know, was impacting everything. And so the way to raise me, and there was a lot of conversation about safety, especially with females, we think about you have to be safe. How do you be safe, right? What's the safest thing you can do? It's your responsibility to stay safe. And for me, it was being raised in this religious environment. And so then I started equating my gender roles and following those gender roles with either going to heaven or hell. And I was like, I'm not going to question anything because I really don't want to land in hell. You know, that's the worst thing that could happen. And so it became like a spiritual value too. So that was not something that I would question growing up. And I think even as an adult, I still sometimes rub up against these things, the idea about self-sacrificing and what does it mean to be a sacrificial woman, for example, so that impacts my parenting, it impacts my partnerships, my relationships, it impacts my work ethic, it impacts my second shift labor, the things I do, you know, around the house without really understanding always that that's what's happening. Now I can slow myself down. I'm like, whoa, wait a second. You know, what are you doing here? This isn't going to help you get to heaven. You know, you can kind of relax that part a little bit because, you know, we've processed that, but it's still there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think about, you know, when we talk about trauma related to this, somebody might be sitting there going, okay, we're talking about social rules, but what does that still have to do with trauma? And, you know, and to me, I see it as it's in two forms. You know, these rules negate our true identity, which is a form of trauma. It comes out as emotional neglect. It comes out as invalidation. It comes out in a lack of confidence and belief that who we are is valuable because we're being told, despite our own inclinations and our natural tendencies, to do something that if it doesn't fit in the rule, then we're wrong. And so to stop thinking that, stop believing that and behave in a certain way. And that becomes a form of, you know, trauma in itself. And then it's the, I think another, you know, kind of shade or variation of it then is maybe you have all those robust feelings and you feel good about it. And you grew up in an environment where that's cool, but you go out into the world and you're punished on a regular basis for still not following the rules. So it doesn't have to just happen in the home, the origin. It happens even outside and externally in the world that we will still, you know, become victimized by that bias. And again, I know what my experience is, but I also know I've seen this with men as well, that they are, you know, traumatized at that first level, like I mentioned, with all the, you know, the roles of what you can and can't do and all that. Are there other forms of trauma that you've seen in your work that should be worth noting for people to kind of explore and wonder like, oh, that might be where some of this is coming from for myself as it relates to the, you know, again, these gender concepts?
Right. I think that one thing that comes to my mind right away is this inner critic that we have and this, you know, kind of mean conversation that we have with ourselves and the fear that we have and the way we scare ourselves over and over again to keep us in line, you know, and I think that's a form of trauma and that's definitely based in gender. Sometimes my inner critic sounds like, I don't know, like Reverend Parrish from the Crucible. Like I just imagine, you know, somebody super strict, but sometimes it sounds like an empowered version of myself, you know, like the really perfectionist version of me that got me that PhD, right? So I can use something that is empowering and something that's very positive and kind of like still turn it in against myself and think, well, but you can't speak up too much, or you got that PhD, but you know, you kind of got lucky because I bet the pool of applicants was pretty small that year, you know, those kinds of things. And that's very real. And men and women both wonder what is going on. We can't figure out why we're self-sabotaging. We can't figure out why we're caught, you know, in these cycles when looking at us, it seems like there's all the evidence in the world that we shouldn't be feeling that way. And so I think that gender is embedded in a lot of different kinds of trauma that we've experienced throughout our lives. And then right now, you know, I talk with all sorts of different clients, but things like the Me Too movement, right? When we see gender-based violence in our country and that comes up and they're just triggered all over again. Even media representations about, you know, men and women and how we sexualize men and women, certain men, certain women, and then the age at which we start sexualizing people too, right? It's very triggering for us and it's linked to gender and it's linked to value based on external qualities. And it just becomes very confusing for adults, let alone kids who are growing up in a system that's just inundated with all these conflicting messages.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And one thing to kind of pull in for people, you know, when we're listening to this is, you know, we kind of think about all the direct messages that we get as being really, and they're very strong on to what we end up getting programmed into the operating system of our heads. But our brain is so complicated. It's, you know, the brain is complex and simple. You know, it dumbs down a lot of things to so that at a conscious level, we don't have to do a lot of thinking. Otherwise, we would go crazy and not be able to process it. But it's actually in the background processing a ton of stuff. And it takes in a lot of the messaging that just is happening around us and just the subtleties and the nuances of behaviors and this, you know, the ways people show up and the way they talk to us, that, you know, trauma is, you know, the overt things that we can probably identify or maybe not so identify, but then this, the system is in there, you know, from the small things of like, what did we regularly see on TV? What did we regularly listen to? You know, I grew up, you know, I'm a Gen Xer. And so by the time I entered the workforce, you know, we talked about diversity hires. So here I was, a woman in engineering. I was like, there was only one other woman in my class, when I graduated. And yet I had interest in me from several firms who really were just looking for the smartest woman they could find to bring in so that they could show representation in their engineering firm. So you're kind of like, well, I just kind of like to think of myself as a good engineer in general, you know, not just that I'm the diversity hire, but, you know, that was kind of like, that seemed to be acceptable to just kind of, you know, have this bucket of, yeah, we're just going to go ahead and we're looking for just a woman so that we can, you know, make sure that we have enough, you know, just enough to be able to look like we're a diverse organization. And that then, of course, makes you wonder, like, okay, well, then when I do get a job, is it just because I'm a diversity hire, or is it because I actually have the qualities and characteristics, you know? And how often do we doubt ourselves in from that point forward, right?
Exactly. And if we're raised to question ourselves and we're operating in fields that have not traditionally been open to folks like us, and our brain's like, oh, see, here's the evidence that you really aren't qualified, that you are just a diversity hire, because they were only looking at a very small pool and only women. So it's not like you really got the job, right? Out of like full merit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and by the way, I rejected all those offers. I went and found my own job someplace else. Right. So I didn't want to do that. Yeah. Okay. Well, so let's see here. Entitlement, you know, one of the things that I know that when I studied for my book and was putting my book together in talking about like these lower levels of entitlement that women demonstrate really everywhere, and these higher levels of entitlement that men seem to demonstrate. And, you know, understanding, you know, what have you found? Do you have any understanding of why that ends up being the case? Because this low sense of entitlement gets in the way of our assertiveness, not in the sense that why bother? You know, it gets in the way of our, you know, negotiations and beliefs about, you know, pushing the envelope to be able to ask for more money and to be able to hold our boundaries, that that we just as women just don't think that we deserve more. And whereas on the other hand, remarkably, and I think one of the studies that I looked at was, you know, men and women were asked to do a task, and the women actually completed more of the answers correctly than the men. And then at the end, they were asked to evaluate and like tip themselves. Would they give themselves any extra money for their completion? The men rated their performance higher than the women did, even though the women actually got more right. And then the men tipped themselves significantly more than what the women actually ended up doing. And then, you know, there've been other recreations of similar studies around there that show that, but, you know, I know that from a coach perspective, and I'm sure you deal with this as a coach perspective, this feeling of entitlement is so strong in terms of its being so low in women. Is that related also to this concept out there? Like, are there messages out there that are consistent that just keep peppering women with this idea that they shouldn't expect more and they should, you know, not ask for more?
Yes. And that they have to work twice as hard, if not more than twice as hard, to achieve what a man would achieve. Right? So that leads to overwork, that leads to perfectionism, that leads to then the overwork and perfectionism exhausting us in the workplace, and then going home, and then the second shift labor thing is happening too, right? And so it completely undercuts then our ability to perform at the highest levels. And so it kind of becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. So yeah, I mean, we see that, you know, people are raised with certain messages. And I also think, though, that there's a pressure that's placed on men and boys at a very young age then to compete at very high levels, too, against other men. So that's something that I want to bring into the conversation as well, because, yes, we do see this, like the stories, statistics that you were bringing up. There's a lot of studies out there about that. But I think we also need to look at how these gender norms negatively impact men too, because I think they're steered into different directions than they're expected to have these high expectations of themselves. And sometimes they do, but they don't always, right? And they're being pushed into realms that don't feel comfortable for them, that aren't really reflective of their passion or their skills or their interests either. And then they have their own sort of, you know, type of imposter syndrome. And then again, we have to look at race and some other categories of identity that go along with that. And in fact, when we talk about the wage gap, we look at how much more women work and how much less they make. But when we talk about the wage gap, and it is real, I know people, some people don't think it's real. It is real.
It's real. It's real. I've looked at just numbers. The data is there. Like it's the CPS, shows the numbers, you know, it's real.
Yeah, it is real. But when we look at that $1 that we're comparing the women's wage to, that's what a white man would earn. Okay. So then we have to look at, all right, well, so then what are, you know, Black men earning? What are Latinos earning? What are Asian men earning? Right. And so there's this whole kind of hierarchy there as well. And then when we say, so women are making, and that depends on your state, but, you know, nationally, I think we've moved to like 82 cents. I'm not sure where we're at today. With that, but that would be white women earning that money. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, African-American women make less and Latinas make even less. And they're pretty significant decreases. It really changes pretty drastically. So, you know, when we talk about all this and we talk about gender and entitlement and all the things, I just want to add, I know it complicates it a little bit, but you know, this system of patriarchy and entitlement and hierarchy is really something that everybody experiences, mm-hmm. you know, and I talk about masculinity, and we hear this concept of toxic masculinity. And I think it's important to say, we're not saying toxic men, we're not saying toxic humans, because I don't think any human is toxic. We're not broken people, but we're in a system that is toxic, that expects men to compete in certain ways, and that values a certain type of masculinity and devalues something that seems more feminized oftentimes. And you mentioned earlier, like the punishment for those, you know, for crossing the line, right? For making a different path for oneself. And those are very clearly evidenced in media. We see, you know, what do we call men who aren't masculine enough, right? And we right. see men often performing the masculinity for other men, because that's the competition that they're expected to engage in from a really early age. And we just say, oh, it's just boys being boys, right? Mm-hmm. But that's taught behavior. That mm-hmm. idea of boys will be boys, we're so familiar with it because everybody says it, because it's a common lesson that we experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I, you know, one of the things that why I address men's mental health on the show is because, well, first of all, it needs to be discussed. It needs to be discussed compassionately. And because one of the very toxic parts of our system is this denial and invalidation that men actually are feeling creatures. You know, a lot of people like to think that, you know, you have to be tough and strong. And like, you know, we just talked about entitlement, push to exceed and excel, to brush off everything and to really just stuff those emotions way down deep inside. Because if you express them, like you cry and you feel sad, you know, you are just, there's a stigma for that for men. And so it has been like, to me, like I said, as the mother of a son who identifies as male, I want him to know he has a full range of capacity and emotions to feel and to do that healthy and expect to be able to be allowed to do that. Because I know from my own experience growing up, certain emotions were off limits for some people because others could not handle all of them. And I remember as I got into my own family, my own life, declaring, I have a right to this emotion. Like, you're just going to give me a minute to feel this and I'm going to do this. And so I want that, you know, for both of my children equally. And I also think that maybe that might be why men listen, is because we do talk about how the systems that we were raised under is a trauma in itself, of when the message you got was that you weren't allowed, whatever that emotion was, you weren't allowed to speak in that way, behave in that way, and act in that way. And that denial of our true self comes out, and how we express that and ventilate that out is destruction to ourselves. Men kill themselves at a higher rate. White yeah. men, middle-aged men, kill themselves at a higher rate than any other demographic out there. And could that be in part to having this superimposed set of rules on top of them and inabilities to escape it, healthy and support systems around there, that that is an exit route for thousands of men in this country every year. And that's what I do. I do believe that. And that's why we talk about this, that it's not just about, oh, woe is me as a woman. I've been, you know, discriminated against and abused and all that other stuff, but it's an abuse on all of us, you know?
Yes, yes. And there are interesting studies out there too about why, you know, these men that you're talking about, this demographic is, you know, why they're killing themselves at such high levels. There's also research about why they feel they need to succeed at a suicide attempt. Because what does that mean if they're not successful at their suicide attempt? And the way that they engage, right, with suicidal behavior is different too than what we see for women. So that's very sad. It's very sad. And it is something that we need to talk about. We also see there's a really high rate of eating disorders among young boys. We often think eating disorders and we think women, we think girls. But why aren't we talking about why there's such a high level of eating disorders, you know, growing level of eating disorders among young men, right? That's another problem. I mean, there's so many of these examples. Why are we medicating our boys, you know, at a higher rate than what we medicate girls for attention deficit disorder, ADHD, you know, because, I mean, you know, there are just all these patterns, right? And then as a parent of a child, you just don't really ask a lot of questions about gender because you're trying to look at your child and the, you know, the problem. And then I think sometimes, you know, I would think as a parent, who am I to question the doctor, you know, about what they're trying to prescribe for my child? Well, I'm the parent, of course, but I didn't always have a gender lens with those kinds of conversations. And, you know, learning to ask more about my own child and look at some of the patterns that we're seeing out there. There's a lot of examples about this, you know, about different phenomena, right, that we talk about more with girls than with boys. It's just this erasure of the privilege. It's why we don't talk about patriarchy using that language. It's why it's so upsetting to people sometimes and triggering when we do use that language. But there's also this terrible thing that happens when we do erase the privilege. And that means we erase the necessary conversations about the pain and the struggles that the people who are in those categories actually do have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I want to start talking about then this integration. You know, how do you bring conversations up like this? You know, my outside of One Broken Mom, you know, this is my volunteer work, air quotes around that, you know, of doing this mental health podcast, you know, outside of this, it is working with leaders and entrepreneurs and businesses and being able to, again, bring a trauma-informed perspective to their leadership skills, either their own identification of where trauma impacts them and how they can show up, you know, as the best leader that they can, how that you can create cultures that are emotionally and psychologically safe so that you end up with, you know, my mission and goal is to stop sending parents home or partners home to their families triggered and traumatized by work so that we can stop them passing it into their dynamic of their home life and their personal life and, you know, which then perpetuates it. So when I come back to this idea of like, when we talk about the inequities that are related to, you know, the patriarchy, and we want to bring the conversation up at work and we want to do it in a way where everyone is safe in the conversation, what do you suggest for leaders to begin to, and people, you know, anybody should, you know, I call them leaders at every level. We all should be able to raise this, you know, this conversation up. What's a good way of doing that? Knowing that, like I said, in the very beginning, the power, you're going to take power away from me. You're going to give power to that person over there. And we start running our scripts of fear and danger, you know, in our heads. And I want to minimize that as much as possible for people.
Yeah. So I think one thing that we can do very easily is just look, let's just notice, look around the room. You know, sometimes that's a conversation that can be had in a smaller group, right? In a group of people who are already having that conversation. So I don't think we can just jump right into it and launch into it at like a big, you know, company-wide meeting, right? That's not going to happen because it's not our goal. Our goal isn't to just surprise everybody and get everybody upset. If we really want to make meaningful change, we have to take a look at the policies written and unwritten. And so, you know, who are the decision makers in this space, whatever workspace you're talking about? And has it always been that way? And what does it mean to diversify that space? And even not just the people, but the way that the system works. So take academia, for example, right? I mean, that's it's a space that has been very like structured, right, for a very long time. And so we might bring in certain folks into the space who haven't traditionally been there, but are we allowing them to bring in new questions? Are we asking for their knowledge production in some very new ways? Or are we just asking them to replicate what's already been done? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one thing is to look around the room. And when I do a gender analysis, you know, my students, I'm like, okay, so where are the people who present as women? Where do you see them? And where are the men, people who present as male? You know, you're just looking around, you're not having a conversation, you're just looking. Okay, so that's just a nice analysis, right? It's by the numbers to take a look at it. So that's one way, but then we have to look at what's actually going on in the space and how are we sharing knowledge, right? How are we getting feedback? What does it mean when we have our advancement, protocols, right? How do we look at the time that people have spent? Going back to academia, because I know that so well, the tenure clock and the biological clock are on the same trajectory, right? And so we wonder why women who are in the academy have a much lower percentage of tenure, and they have children, but they may have like one, right? We don't see many women academics who have more than one child. I had three. I was like really out there. I don't even know. I was looking at it before the podcast today, and I was thinking about, I got my master's, and I thought, I was pregnant when I got my master's. And then I got my PhD, and I was pregnant when I got my PhD. Good thing I'm not going for anything else, because I don't know what I was doing.
Be another kid.
Though, right? It's unusual. And then we don't really see men's tenure affected in the same way. And during the pandemic, for example, we know that more women have lost their jobs than men. But in going back to academia, we see that women's publishing rates, which they have to have in order to get tenure and advancement and rank, have decreased so much because of the homeschooling and the extra work going on at home. And we see that the rates of men's publications have increased significantly. So that means there's going to be, you know, more men getting tenure after this bubble of time with the pandemic. So we need to take a look at not just who's occupying what spaces, but also what are the policies that, you know, are enabling us to continue on the same trajectory, just with different people in those spaces. We have to look at sort of like the overarching, you know, mission of the institution and the leadership structures too.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's following what's been going on with women in the last year. I mean, it's obviously in my wheelhouse too, because I'm a woman in the field, and seeing the, you know, the attrition of like 2 to 3 million women from the workforce, either out of choice, because, we call it choice, right? Some choose, like, I know that my family needs me, I need to leave. Some not, you know, by choice, it just completely, you know, laid off or fired or, you know, furloughed for whatever. And then, I was working with one of the companies, and they're like, there was a retirement, an astronomical number of people out of their pool were just retired out of safety. And a pool that was mostly women, they're just like, it's not worth it, you know, for me to, I'm just going to quit this career path altogether before getting into it. And there is just going to be a vacuum, an unusual vacuum that I don't know, like, and you pointing out that tenure, like, that's an astonishing difference in there. And the men will receive the tenure because the system is set up to reward them and to punish to some extent the women. So women could receive tenure if you change the system. That's what your point is saying, is like, as long as the policy stays, you're going to see fewer women be able to receive that, because the way it's written, it discourages and actually is a demerit to, you know, what we haven't been able to do, or what most women haven't been able to do in the last like year and a half to 18 months. And it's going to continue on. I mean, we're still talking about schools at this point. We're recording this in August of 2021. And, you know, schools are not on a firm go plug straight ahead, you know, kind of a road right now. So
yeah. And also too, when we think about what work actually looks like, and the the kind of products we're producing, it's all, you know, changing pretty rapidly. So we saw a professor at UNC who was writing for the New York Times off, you know, very regularly, right? And she was not granted tenure right away because they were questioning the kinds of publications she had because they weren't academic publications. And I think now with COVID, we're asking a lot of questions about value, about what matters, what's normal, what do we want to go back to? And we do have this opportunity to take a look at things and say, you know, I don't know that we need to go back to this because maybe it was normal, but was it healthy? And I think we have an opportunity to ask those kinds of questions now that we really haven't had in the past.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a huge, you know, reset happening at the moment. And of course, resets feel really bad. You know, they don't, you know, they themselves. So it's never like resets always happen at good times. I think I mentioned this just the other day on a post. It's like resets usually happen at a moment you think you can't afford the reset, but it's usually at a perfect time for that. Because when you feel like it's not the right time, it's usually, it is always, you know, the right time for that. So
yeah, and it hurts. It hurts. And that's okay. It's uncomfortable. And that's okay. It doesn't mean anything has gone wrong, really. It means that we're looking for something else. We're asking brand new questions and getting really different information. And yeah, that's uncomfortable, but it's okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I'd like to ask you is we were going to talk about imposter syndrome, and I think people do, and we've talked about it a little bit here, but you know, how does somebody, if they have this feels, you know, inside of them, and imposter syndrome sounds recent. I think for a lot of people, it feels like it's a newer term, but it actually goes back a couple of decades, I believe, like this concept of this. You know, what's a good takeaway for somebody that's listening to this that, you know, now says, you know, all those wobbles inside of my gut that tell me I'm not good enough, male or female, you know, alike, you know, how do you start on a path to be able to break up with that feeling inside of yourself so that you can, you know, get more comfortable with taking on different risks or opportunities or, you know, whatever it may be personally and professionally.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not alone. That's what some people really love about knowing that imposter syndrome exists, because they thought it was just them. I thought it was just me. I thought it was based on, you know, some past trauma or some flaw that I constantly felt like I wasn't enough, even though I was getting more degrees to prove to everybody that I was enough, you know, and I still didn't feel that way. So, yeah, knowing that imposter syndrome actually is a concept, and we've been studying it since the late 70s. I think some of the first publications were in 76 or 78, actually. And we're talking about it all over again because the pandemic has changed what the office looks like and has changed what work looks like. So if these feelings of, you know, I'm not good enough, they're going to find out, I have to work so hard just to, you know, earn as much as somebody else or just to be as good as somebody else. If it takes you 20 minutes to write an email that probably could have taken 5, you're not alone. It's okay. Your brain is doing the thing that it's meant to do, which is it spots danger. It knows there's some sort of a risk and is trying to keep you safe. The thing is, in trying to keep you safe, it wears you out. It gives you these expectations of perfection, which don't exist, right? I tell my clients, the only thing you can be perfect at is being you. So let's do that. But like, you know, being perfect means there's always more work to do. And it makes us, you know, afraid. And so when we achieve something, we have a, you know, a milestone of some sort, we think, oh my God, now I've done this really good thing. I have to keep it up, or I have to do more, I have to do better. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel like we've accomplished something. It just feels like doom and gloom, right? That's imposter syndrome, and you're not alone. And there are ways to deal with it. And in my coaching, I coach around imposter syndrome, and I coach a lot of doctoral students, a lot of grad students who are dealing with this, but a lot of high achieving folks who have a, you know, track record of success, and they're still wondering, why do they feel like they're not enough? And I call that coaching beyond imposter syndrome, because I do think systems are broken. I do think systems are based on inequity. Systems are based on patriarchy and, you know, race and white supremacy culture. And so the systems are broken. So of course it doesn't feel good to you. You know, it wasn't designed for you to, you know, naturally fit in, right? And so we always feel like we have to modify ourselves. So there are ways to, you know, manage the real feelings and effects of imposter syndrome without having to totally revamp the system, you know, and be Wonder Woman out there.
Yeah. You know, and I've thought about this, you know, again, more so in just even in the last like few months, like imposter syndrome is so prevalent and widespread. Like, it's almost like, is it a syndrome anymore? Or is it just a human experience? Right. Like, you know, when you only have a few people, like, okay, it's a, it, you know, you can identify it as a thing that happens to like these, you know, hallmark population of people, but really everybody, you know, whether they talk about it or not, there are these levels of doubt and low self-confidence that creep in, and some of it worse than others for other people. Trauma can actually exacerbate it, especially if you had very, you know, authoritative or degrading or, you know, types of a life experience that made you doubt your inner world and your inner self. And I've talked about that a lot of times on the show, but even then, like what we've been talking about today, the system outside around you can signal to you in ways that you're not good enough. Social media can do it at you, right? You can, and I had this happen to me once. I put out a video about, you know, the discomfort we have at work with addressing some challenging issues. And it was a, you know, it was a specific video, and somebody pops up and they're like, you don't have a degree in psychology. Should you really be posting stuff like this about this? And it was like, shut off, claim, you know, just kind of like, I'm not saying I'm your therapist. I'm telling you, you know, I'm raising awareness about it. But when those, that system that allows us to be able to also knock people down, you know, or take them down, God, just it's everywhere. You know, we all, yeah, experience it.
Yeah, it really is. And I do call my coaching Beyond Imposter Syndrome, because I really don't like the pathologizing of individuals. Like you said, do I have a syndrome? Am I doing something wrong? That's the last thing we need when we're feeling like we're not enough anyway, right? Like we're feeling like we're the problem. And so, yeah, so when I coach around it, I look at what's going on with the systems, but it does have a very real impact on us. And especially people who we should be celebrating, right? Like first generation students. I was a first generation student. I had no idea what college was about, let alone a master's or a PhD. I didn't know what I was doing. I would have loved coaching. Seriously, I would have really loved some coaching, right? When I was going through that process. But instead of, I think, you know, really feeling good that you're like this trailblazer, you just kind of feel more afraid and more afraid each step you take. You kind of want to shrink back. So yeah, I think there's a lot of resources out there, but you're right. I think it's quite widespread.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Definitely. Unfortunately, but also there's comfort in knowing that you're not alone, right? Yeah. Totally. Well, so you've mentioned your coaching services, and I'll have a link to your website in the podcast notes for anybody that wants to work with you. You know, how many, you know, how much of this is with you being a professor? I imagine you're quite busy then, being a professor and also being a business coach. Are there other ways people can reach out to you, like books or anything else that people can also grab?
So I'm doing something new, talking about imposter syndrome. I've been on Clubhouse. This is, you know, are you on Clubhouse?
I'm not on Clubhouse. Yeah, but I know Clubhouse. And my feelings on Clubhouse are only that, again, like we talked about before the interview started, I tend to get in a box, and when I come out, I'm ready to come out. And then when I'm not, I don't want to be in it. And Clubhouse felt like another one of those places where I had to be there all the time. And I'm like, nope, don't want to do it.
Yeah. So no, I'm not there all the time, and I'm allowing myself to feel confused and by everything that's there. But I'm on Clubhouse every Friday with a friend of mine, because I really think that these conversations should be free and available to everybody, because this is the revolution. This is the way we make change. One person talking to another person and letting some other folks hear, or letting other folks join into the conversation who may not, you know, pay tuition to take a class. This should be free and open to everybody. So this is our new thing. It's every Friday at 11 a.m. Central Time. We're on Clubhouse. It's called Gender Matters. And this month we're talking about imposter syndrome. Next month we're going to be talking about feminism. And it's very open and interactive. And you can find me at my website, of course. And then I've got a blog as well, and I'm writing on the Medium. You know, the other thing that I do a lot of is global scholarship. I'm a global gender scholar, and I just love to look at what patriarchy looks like everywhere, because it helps me with my own clients as they're trying to understand patriarchy in their own lives. And I study feminist activism. So I love to see how people are disrupting it in public spheres and also individually. And I think it really informs, you know, the systems and the individuals. So you can find me, you know, on social media. I'm kind of all over the place these days. And just having a really good time trying new things and experiencing my own imposter syndrome and just jumping right into it.
Awesome. Well, good for you for that. Right. Getting past our uncomfortableness is, you know, yeah, is important. So that's cool. Well, this has been great. Like I said, beforehand, you know, we were introduced to each other by somebody else who's a guest on the show who reached out to me. And, you know, this whole year I've networked and met so many awesome, cool people in the course of this time. And, you know, so I was so excited to be able to meet you and then have to be able an opportunity to have this conversation. You know, like I said, at the top of this, you know, I want to be able to bring this topic in a way, and podcasts, I do believe, are a great medium for all of us to kind of privately question and get curious without it being a public discussion. And so while on social media, when I bring up some stuff like this, and I know it can be triggering because people see it and they feel compelled to comment, then they read other comments and all that other stuff, with a podcast, it allows you to be able to just listen to it, go on a walk, sit in your car, be by yourself, contemplate some of the things. And I think what, you know, what you've brought in today in this perspective, I think it's important for all of us because it does relate to our mental health. It relates to our livelihoods. It relates to our parenting, our sense of beliefs, and our self-worth. And it's worth an examination for us to be able to talk about this in a psychologically safe place. And I think you nailed it today. So thank you so much for that, Michelle.
Thanks for having me. I feel like gender is such a wide conversation. We could talk 10 more times and not even scratch the surface. But I'm glad that we had this chat today. And I'm just really hopeful that, you know, it resonated somehow with people, because I think, you know, gender impacts all of us. So if we're just open to asking that question, how does gender matter in my life, or what's gender have to do with this? I just think it opens up a really interesting excavation.
It does. Yep. Agree. Cool. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiequercone.com. And there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quercone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.